Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. It's good to have you with us on this Friday, and we never forget you here at The Takeaway. But you know, sometimes it's hard to remember almost anything else. Well, that's why we have a lesson today on why forgetfulness, daydreaming, and distractions are, in fact, good things, how they help us to absorb new information and improve our learning. Also, 50 years after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Wilderness Act into law, 110 million acres of land are now protected. So how come it's so hard to decide what's wild and what isn't? But today we start in North Carolina. This weekend, Henry Lee McCollum and his half-brother Leon Brown will enjoy their first week of freedom in more than 30 years. Just think about that for a second. What were you doing 30 years ago, assuming you were even born then? Well, both men were released this week from a North Carolina prison. DNA evidence uncovered by the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission exonerated McCollum and Brown of the rape and murder in 1983 of an 11-year-old girl named Sabrina Bowie in Red Springs, North Carolina. Brown and McCollum were teenagers at the time of their conviction. Both men are mentally disabled, and both were sentenced to die. And although Leon Brown's conviction was eventually changed to life in prison, Henry McCollum's death sentence was upheld, making him the longest-serving inmate on death row in the state. 152 men remain on death row in Raleigh's Central Prison. James Payne is Leon Brown's attorney, and he says both men's innocence is only further proof to him that the death penalty needs some rethinking.
The main evidence that convicted him were the false confessions of Mr. Brown, the false confession of Mr. McCollum, and a second witness who, for lack of a better word, was quite discredited, who had said that the defendants had made some admissions with regard to the rape and murder. But there was no physical evidence tying either young man to the scene of the crime.
Well, what were the circumstances of the confession? Was it coerced or otherwise under duress?
I have been careful, Mr. Zwillick, not to use the word coerced. There are false confessions, and false confessions can occur without having been coerced, but the circumstances are very important. One, both young men, boys, were mentally retarded at the time. Mr. Brown had the IQ of 54, was operating at a second-degree reading level. Mr. McCollum, not much better. They were in a room with experienced law enforcement officers for hours, separated. In Mr. McCollum's room was the crime scene investigator who knew all of the factual details of the crime scene and knew about the condition of Miss Sabrina Bowie's body, particularly the fact that her panties were found stuffed down her throat and broken off with a stick. In addition to that, Mr. McCollum had always maintained that he was told, if you just admit to what you're doing, you'll get to go home. So is Mr. Brown. Significantly, when Mr. McCollum signed the statement, which was written by somebody else, he got up to walk out of the room. Law enforcement officer said, where are you going? He said, well, you said I could go home. That's not something that can be staged.
Well, it's not the first case, certainly, of false confessions that we've ever heard about. But why did it take 30 years or close to 30 years to get these convictions overturned? Was there new DNA evidence that convicted somebody else?
Well, the direct answer to that would be that there is new DNA evidence that has not been used to convict anybody else, but that did two things, pointed to another individual and DNA evidence that excluded Brown and McCollum from the scene. The DNA evidence, of course, was not available back in 1983 and 1984. We have in North Carolina, and we're unique because we're a pioneer in that, the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. That commission was petitioned by Mr. Brown, who got some help from an inmate. Mr. Brown asked the commission to investigate his case. They are a neutral fact-finding body, pioneered by our former Chief Justice, I. Beverly Lake. That fact-finding body had a lot more investigative authority, commenced its investigation in 2010, amongst which was interviews, of course, of both men, interviews of numerous witnesses, but significantly the DNA evidence. It excluded them by finding that their DNA was not at the crime scene on critical pieces of evidence.
We'll come back to Mr. Brown and Mr. McCollum in a minute because they have a new life to start outside of prison after all of these years. But, Mr. Payne, taking a step back from this case a little bit, what does it tell you? I don't know where you come down on the death penalty and capital punishment, but what does this case tell you about the many calls for conclusive scientific evidence or DNA in order to convict for the death penalty, for that sentence, rather than a life sentence?
That evidence would have to be left up, in my mind, to the province of a jury. Now, what is important to know is that defendants, particularly in North Carolina anyway, have the right to acquire court-appointed funds to conduct DNA testing. And that right should be protected, of course, but that allows a defendant to have equal footing by conducting their own testing on whatever particular item of physical evidence that they might want to do.
Mr. Payne, of course, false conviction and ultimately the execution of an innocent person has always been the standard for a lot of people to show that the death penalty should be abolished. Maybe we're not on the cusp of abolition anytime soon, but what does this case say to you about that larger debate?
To me, this case stands as a shining example why we should not have it. This case was used by one of the justices of the Supreme Court as a reason why the death penalty was a good thing.
Who was that justice?
That was Justice Scalia, and he pointed directly to Mr. McCollum. And, of course, we now know that Mr. McCollum was totally innocent.
In other words, Mr. McCollum and Mr. Brown would have been examples we know now, had their executions gone through, of a definitive case of an innocent person being put to death by the state.
Exactly. And Mr. McCollum spent 30 years on death row, and Mr. Brown himself spent 5 years.
Well, now we're at the point, Mr. Payne, where both those brothers, including your client, Leon Brown, have been set free. Hard to imagine or even really ask about how life begins after that long in a penitentiary for all those many years. What kind of plans does your client, Mr. Brown, have for starting life, for coping?
His first plan, Mr. Zwillick, was to go to McDonald's and have a hamburger and a milkshake. He's a man of few words. He's been institutionalized for 31 years. He's lost his entire life as an adult. He wants to get out, get a job, get a trade, and learn to be a productive citizen, to make a contribution to society as best he can.
And without violating privilege, if I can ask you, what did Leon Brown say to you the moment you told him he would be set free?
God is good.
Well, Leon Brown is going to experience life outside of prison for the first time in 31 years, as will his half-brother, Henry Lee McCollum, both set free from penitentiary in North Carolina after their convictions were overturned on death row for the 1983 rape and murder of Sabrina Bowie. Leon Brown's lawyer is James Payne. Mr. Payne, thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Willick.
Well, one thing that America has plenty of, that's space. Sure, it can feel crowded sometimes in the cities, but we know and we love the big empty parts. More than 100 million acres are officially designated as wilderness in this country. In a moment, we'll talk about the ongoing battle to protect the wild, but already you've been taking us to your places where the wild calls.
Lonnie Darty in Stillwater, Oklahoma. My greatest time in nature was on an early morning horseback ride near South Fork, Colorado several years ago. And we were riding along and the elk were bugling on the mountain above us. Turkeys were gobbling in the valley below and we rode up on a big mule deer buck.
This is Amanda from Dallas, Texas. And my favorite memory is traveling up the old Fall River Road in Rocky Mountain National Park in Estes Park, Colorado, at dusk, quietly watching the elk and bighorn sheep come out to feed.
This is Daisy from Okotie, South Carolina, and my favorite place in nature is my back porch overlooking the Colleton River, especially at sunrise and sunset.
You can add your voice to everyone who's telling us how they best commune with nature. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us more. And also, please, hey, leave us some directions, if you would. Coming up, we venture into the great wide open. That's next on The Takeaway. Spent part of your summer enjoying the great American outdoors, you might well have been appreciating the results of the Wilderness Act. But 50 years after the passage of this conservation law, creating wilderness has gotten a lot more difficult. The vast majority of wilderness protected in the United States today was created before 1990, and since then, gridlock. Very few designations have gotten through Congress. David Steves, editor at EarthFix, a public media collaborative in the Northwest, explains why. He joins us from Portland. Welcome, David.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you, David. You know, I cover Congress, so I know it's one thing to get a wilderness bill through the gridlock morass that is Congress. That's step two. Step one is getting it done at the local level, which is where you are.
Right. Yeah. Our reporter, Cassandra Profita, went out to one of those areas to really see what it's like at the ground level in eastern Oregon. It's in the Owyhee Canyonlands area. And she really found out just how much divided sentiment there is about designating wilderness these days.
Now, there are lots of wilderness activists, environmental activists who want a wilderness designation in Owyhee. They've gone up against a lot of different groups of people, a real coalition at the same time, including the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Listen to this.
See all this? This will all be wilderness. And we're going to fight it for everything we're worth.
Well, that's Bob Skinner. He's the public lands director at the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, David Steves. He sounds serious.
Yeah, he is. He's also a rancher. And you know, you talked about gridlock in Congress. Well, when there was this group of various stakeholders, they had no problem reaching a unanimous decision. They did not want a wilderness designation in the Owyhee Canyonlands. It's about a 2-million-acre area. And one of the issues that comes to play now that really wasn't such an issue back 50 years ago when the Wilderness Act was adopted, is that a lot of the areas that we're talking about as potential wilderness areas, people are using them more than those original wilderness areas that were kind of high elevation, mountainous sorts of preserves where you didn't find as much ranching. You know, Bob Skinner, who you just played that cut from, he runs a ranch. He's got cattle, and he was actually speaking while flying an airplane with our reporter who was up in the plane with him, you know, because he's got this vast area, and a lot of the cattle do graze on these public lands that would be designated as wilderness. And the Wilderness Act has some real strict rules on what people can and cannot do when it's got that protective barrier around that area.
And that's what I want to ask you about. I mean, it's easy to understand that if it's a wilderness protected area, you can't ranch. So somebody like Bob Skinner would be out of luck. And I get his point of view. What else can't you do on land like that that has so many different groups of people opposed to it? There are disability groups, seniors groups. A lot of different people don't want this.
Well, let me just back up and make a minor clarification that, you know, because of this kind of activity, ranching, one of the advocacy groups that is proposing wilderness designation is quoted in our story saying that would be grandfathered if it's considered an appropriate use. So I think it would go through a regulatory process. So I don't want to give the impression that just flat out couldn't ranch. But generally, there are restrictions. You cannot use mechanized equipment. You can't have roads in wilderness areas that you'd be driving on. I did one of the stories in our series, and, you know, the road ends at the Goat Rocks Wilderness Area where I hiked in and interviewed some folks. the trail work that was done there didn't involve chainsaws. If a tree falls and, blocks a trail, then you've got trail crews working with handsaws, you know, a blast from the, 19th century technology to clear those off, because that's a clear, requirement under the Wilderness Act. They use some really pretty poetic language about, it's a place where man is a visitor and it is not trammeled by men. It's a wild place.
Not even enough for a chainsaw. Well, let's give equal time to the other side of this, of course. Let's hear from Julie Weichel. She's a board member of the Oregon Natural Desert Association.
This is a chunk of country that's not too damaged yet. Because it's desert country, it can easily be harmed.
And there you have the concern of a lot of folks in the environmental community, the preservation community.
That's right. Yeah. Where we're talking about, where our story took a look, and again, in the desert country in eastern Oregon, there are mines operating just outside the proposed wilderness boundaries. We do have, the longer that an area goes, wilderness advocates would tell you, the greater the risk that eventually it will lose some of that wild nature and some of the things that really make it a special place.
David Steves, one fact that amazed me before we let you go, 85% of the wilderness that's been cleared by Congress legally happened before 1990. They're just not doing it that much anymore. It seems like this is really a dwindling argument. They're having this argument in Owyhee Canyon in Oregon, but maybe in another couple of years it'll be down to zero.
It's really hard to say. I do think you talked about the gridlock in Congress, and Senator Wyden, Ron Wyden from Oregon, was interviewed for our story, and he did talk about how much that's a factor. And there's just a philosophical divide. Rural communities, in 1964, they were not feeling under economic assault the way they are out west here when it comes to ranching and mining and, timber production. And so I think there's just a real strong philosophical feeling that, look, let's just not give another inch here. We've got plenty of area that's just locked up, and we would like to use our resources for our own economic betterment as well as for recreation and, for ecological purposes.
Well, in Oregon, the ranching and mining and timber crowd meet up with the no chainsaw crowd in Owyhee Canyon. It's a big debate that hasn't even reached Congress yet. David Steves, editor at the EarthFix Public Media Collaboration in Oregon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Tickets, please.
Fridays are movie days here on The Takeaway, and that means we head to our movie date team, our movie date podcast team as well. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and Kristen Meinzer, cultural producer here at The Takeaway and co-hosts of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Todd.
Hey, Todd.
You can subscribe to the Movie Date podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. As usual, trivia first. Kristen, I don't know if you're going to get this one. You might.
Never get them.
They're usually designed for you to fail, but you might get this one. We'll see. We're talking about a Vietnam movie today, Last Days in Vietnam, Rory Kennedy's new film. She was on the show yesterday. Well, here's your trivia. Don't answer yet. We're going to save the answer for the end of the segment. 1979 was the year of battling Vietnam movies at the Oscars. Now, Deer Hunter won Best Picture, but what other movie won Best Writing, Best Actor, and Best Actress? That's your question. We're going to come back to it at the end. Don't answer yet. Now, we're going to get to Last Days in Vietnam in a minute. But first, guys, Identical. This is a movie about twin brothers unknowingly separated at birth. One of them becomes an iconic rock and roll star, while the other one struggles to balance his love for music and pleasing his father. I think it's what, Kristen, an Elvis story?
It's kind of a what-if story with Elvis.
All right, well, let's listen.
Look, I know a lot of songs, and I'll sing every one of them until you say yes.
Kid, the jig's up. Here comes the heat.
Might this be the disturbing the peace call?
You called the cops on me?
Oh, I didn't call them. And why are there always police involved with you and me?
Kristen? Officer, look, I ain't going anywhere until this girl agrees to go out on a date with me.
Ooh, I jumped the gun a little bit there. Kristen, we have Ray Liotta, Ashley Judd, Seth Green. What do you think?
You know, we also have this guy. This is so interesting. The guy who plays the kind of Elvis doppelganger, and the Elvis sort of character in this movie, actually was an Elvis impersonator when he was discovered for this movie. So it's just very meta. There's like layers and layers of Elvises in this whole movie. I thought it was a lot of fun. It's ridiculous. It's all over the place. Sometimes you're wondering, why are these big speeches about the state of Israel in this movie? You don't understand why some of the stuff is in there. But for the most part, I thought it was just fun, good-spirited nonsense, and I enjoyed it.
Rafer, what if Elvis had a lost twin?
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea where the story was going in the first place with this whole scenario, but I have to say the odd pro-Israel messages in this film,
what?
Which come out of nowhere. I mean, it's an opinion, you know, we can support the state of Israel, but I mean, what is it doing in an Elvis Presley movie? I have no idea. I have to say, this is the strangest movie I've seen in years. It's so bizarre. The Elvis impersonator guy, Blake Rain, pretty good, but what a strange idea for a film.
Strange movie. Rafer, I think you're voting for it based strictly on strangeness.
Perhaps.
Now, let's go to Last Days in Vietnam. Rory Kennedy was on the show yesterday, talked to her about her new film documenting the last 24 to 48 hours before the fall of Saigon. A fascinating movie. I will put my vote in for it right away. Let's hear a cut from the movie. This is Richard Armitage, who became Deputy Secretary of State in our own current era, talking about his role in the last days of Vietnam.
We steamed down to Con Son Island, and we could see on the radar display that there were a lot of blips. And I remember at dawn breaking, the sun coming up, and seeing what I had seen as a radar display in person. There were dozens of ships. And not just Vietnamese naval ships, but also civilian ships. And they were all totally crammed with people.
Rafer, I was riveted by this movie.
Yeah, I think one thing that's good about this film is there's been enough time passed now that I think people are willing to be candid and very honest. And I think the film does a really good job of showing the mistakes that the United States made and also its attempts to do the right thing. And there's kind of tragedy in between that mix. It's a pretty affecting film.
Kristen?
I thought what was most effective were the stories being told by the people who were actually trying to escape, who weren't part of the U.S. military, not part of the U.S. political machine. Families. There's one story that's unbelievable that could have its own movie of a family that takes a helicopter out to a ship. They can't land the helicopter on the ship, and they're jumping one by one onto the ship and being caught by U.S. military. It's unbelievable. The movie's very detailed. It's very touching, and the people are amazing. Their stories are amazing.
And Rory Kennedy described that movie, that part of the movie yesterday. It was absolutely fascinating. That's Last Days in Vietnam. Well, I wanted a chance to talk to both of you guys for a minute because in 2010, you sat down with the one and only Joan Rivers for the Movie Date podcast. Of course, we're all remembering her life. She died at 81. I just want to real quickly hear from Joan Rivers from The Runway with Melissa in 2008. Listen.
It looks like they took her and wrapped it in yards and yards and yards of fabric. Like, she looked like she was dressed by Martha Stewart's towel department.
Kristen, what was it like to sit down with Joan Rivers?
I was squealing with delight. I was so excited. I've always been a big fan of hers. My grandma and I were big fans, so she's a real personal family connection for me also, as somebody we just loved as a family. And so smart, so groundbreaking, such a trailblazer, and such a role model for people in entertainment and for women in general.
Rafer, I'm sure she took a dig at you.
You know, she didn't. She was very wonderful, but that was one of the first interviews I'd ever done on the radio. And, you know, Joan Rivers really controls a room. And, you know, how can you go head to head with Joan Rivers? I was just some dude trying to get a quote out of her. You know, she dominated me, that's for sure.
Well, we heard some snippets from your interview earlier in the show. We're going to make sure that people can go back and listen to that, your 2010 sit down with Joan Malinsky, as I call her. It's wonderful that you got a chance to do that, and I'm very, very jealous. Well, let's go back to trivia, and I'm going to repeat the question that we had at the top since we were talking about the last days in Vietnam today. Here was your question. 1979 was the year of battling Vietnam movies at the Oscars. Deer Hunter won Best Picture. What other movie won Best Writing, Best Actor, Best Actress? Kristen.
The actress thing's throwing me off. Coming Home?
Kristen Meinzer, correct.
Oh my gosh, the first time I ever got a trivia answer.
To Jane Fonda.
I'm so happy. I wanted to win very much because I'm so proud of coming home.
Let this mark the day that Kristen Meinzer came home to a correct answer in the movie Date in the movie trivia contest. Kristen Meinzer, congratulations.
Thank you.
Rafer Guzman, also on the Movie Date podcast, our Movie Date team. You can download the Movie Date podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Kristen, congratulations.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, you've heard this advice before. Find a quiet place to study and stick with it at the same time every day. Good habits, right? But thanks to brain imaging and advances in neuroscience, we've learned a lot about learning over the last few years. And it turns out that that quiet little corner of the library may not be the best place for you to retain and store information, and that we may learn best by forgetting. Benedict Carey is a science reporter for our partner, The New York Times. In researching his new book, How We Learn, The Surprising Truths About When, Where, and Why It Happens, Carey discovered that we learn best when we exploit the quirks built into our brains through evolution.
Our ideas about how the brain works are fairly recent ones. There are recent constructs that are come from education, that it works in concentrated blocks, in classrooms, by doing homework, by doing practice, and so on. Using that language blinds us to the way the brain essentially learned to learn, which is over the sort of course of evolution, human evolution, it learned by foraging and scavenging in the same way that we forage for food and for shelter. And so that's a very different kind of learning than the one we think about when we say the word learning. When you see that big picture, you begin to appreciate all these quirky things the brain does.
One of the things I took from your book here, and I might be overstating it, is kind of a polemic against rote memorization, sort of spelling bee, times tables, ruler-based learning that maybe is a thing of the past now, but for a lot of kids and a lot of adults, not so much.
That's right. It has a polemical quality, absolutely. I mean, the reason I wrote this, I thought, I mean, this is crazy. I mean, we're really taught to study and practice like monks, isolate the material from our lives to, find one quiet space, to have a ritual, to stay with that ritual, to avoid distractions. And to the extent that we fail that, we feel we've failed. We haven't done it right. This is why I wrote this. I thought, I mean, this is crazy. We're following all this advice and feeling bad when we don't kind of live up to this ideal, and the ideal's wrong. And so that needs to change.
You say that forgetting is a good thing.
That's
for
right.
Instance.
Forgetting is a sort of has multiple properties, and when you look at it, it's kind of amazing to see what it does. It's we think of it as the enemy of learning. What the learning science is showing is that in fact it's the strongest ally of learning, and it does a couple things. One is it acts as a very sophisticated spam filter. So if you're looking for a fact or a name or a figure or a formula or something like that, it's in your brain. But it's linked to thousands of other things that are similar. So you need to be able to filter those things out to select out like that kind of needle in a haystack that you're looking for. And it's suppressing the memory of the other things, that is actively filtering or forgetting them, that allows you to make the selection. Forgetting is a little bit like muscle breakdown. So a little bit of forgetting, you hear something, you study something. A day later, you don't remember it quite as well. When you restudy, it strengthens that memory times 10 because the breakdown has allowed you to strengthen the memory even more, as like muscle breakdown does when you work out.
What's more important, do you think, in ultimately learning is about recall, having access to the information? Is it storage or being able to access a memory? I find so often, we've all had this feeling, it's not that you don't know something, it's that you go, and then when you remember it or somebody reminds you, you knew it was in there, but you couldn't find the path to it.
Exactly. That is, you're talking about storage strength and retrieval strength as two ideas in the theory of cognitive science. And that theory says if you store it, it's there forever. It's retrieval that's hard. Okay, retrieval is a much more fickle thing. It's finite. It doesn't contain as much. And that is the set of things that you have available to you at any given time. And so learning is really a way of trying to work with the retrieval side and to train it to be able to pick up what you want when you want it.
Well, you knew this part was coming, Benedict Carey, but it's time for a little bit of advice. I mean, what can we do? What does the science say about what I can do to improve my learning capability and this faltering memory system that I have? What does the science say? What have you compiled about what I can really do? in my everyday life.
Absolutely. There's a half a dozen things you can do right now. One of them is to vary the places where you study or practice. Simple, vary location. Change the rooms, inside, outside, go to a cafe. I was a very restless college student, and I did all of that stuff. I was up and down all the time. I still am. That, cognitive scientists have shown that that kind of variability increases the number of cues related with the, you know, information you're learning, and also makes it independent of any particular one spot. So you don't need to go back to your, you know, you don't need to go back to your basement study room to remember the stuff you're studying. You're carrying it with you. Another thing you can do is you can play with your schedule, that is, your study schedule, very simply by breaking up the amount of study time you have. So instead of doing it all on Tuesday night, you do 1 hour on Tuesday, one on Wednesday, or one on Thursday, and wait a week. That simple variation, that simple distribution of the time can double what you remember.
You didn't mention one thing, and I want to ask about it.
Yep.
How strong is the science on the effect of sleep directly on learning and recall? I've heard a lot of different things.
Yeah.
I'm a guy who does not sleep enough.
Right.
I never have because I'm a night owl and that's how I'm wired. Does it make me dumber?
Does it make you dumber? I don't know. I suspect you should get more sleep. That's what I'd say,
sure.
Todd. But this is a very contentious area, okay? But the preponderance of the evidence right now says this. The big picture is sleep is learning. It's a special kind of learning. It's learning consolidation. Okay, so when you go to sleep after you've studied or practiced something, your brain is actively sorting, picking out the most meaningful stuff.
Reformatting that hard drive.
Reformatting, that's right, and flagging the most important things. Sleep finishes the job of learning. That is, that theory is pretty well established now. There is a lot of debate over other parts of sleep and learning. But the evidence right now suggests the following thing, which is very interesting, that the first half of the night is retention territory. That's when deep sleep occurs, and that's when your brain consolidates, is more specialized to consolidate facts, figures, faces, and so on. The second half of the night is loaded with a different kind of processing that is more specialized to motor skills, like music and athletics, and REM sleep, which is thought to really improve sort of comprehension, seeing hidden patterns, the kind of thing we use in math. So that has some very clear ramifications. If you're going to truncate your sleep to study, prepare for something, well, if it's a foreign language, you want that first half of the night, so you can wake up a little early. But the flip side is the better strategy if you are studying, for example, for a math test, okay, which is less about retention and more about comprehension and seeing hidden patterns. There, you want that morning sleep.
There are lots of strategies that you can use, data-driven, scientifically-driven strategies you can use to learn better. Context is huge, according to Benedict Carey. He's a science reporter for The New York Times and author of How We Learn, the Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. Benedict Carey, thanks for letting us learn from you.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, as we get to the end of today's show, we've been remembering comedian Joan Rivers all hour. And for final requests, let Joan Rivers speak for herself.
When I die, I want my funeral to be a huge showbiz affair with lights and cameras and action. I want craft services. I want paparazzi. I want publicists making a scene. I want it to be Hollywood all the way. Don't give me some rabbi rambling on. I want Meryl Streep crying in five different accents.
Joan Rivers' funeral will be Sunday in New York. It's going to be a wild event, I'm sure. We can't guarantee a red carpet. We can't guarantee paparazzi or publicists making a scene. But Joan, we can give you one thing. Here's Meryl Streep crying in five different accents.
The words were inside of me. I was wrong to stay, but I can't go.
It's okay. Just leave me alone, okay?
Oh, I have doubts.
I thought I should have painted clouds downtown because ja, mein Hauptmann, ich glaube an Christus.
That one's for you, Joan Rivers. You cracked me up for 30 years. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.